Daf Gimel Amid Beis Maseches Rosh Hashanah. Go on. So the point that they're making is at this particular point that if we are to say that his kingdom is to be dated from when? From the month of Nisan, right? Like Jewish kings, then in that particular case, if it's written Bachodesh HaChamishi, which of course would be the month of Av, right? And he still says the Tishnas Hashviz, right? And still the seventh year. So the Gemara says, Shnas Hashminis Miboyle. It should have read the eighth year, right? The Yod. So that was argument number one. Here is argument number two. He says, Me dummy. He says, Tell me, are they the same? Hasam Koresh. Before, we were talking about King Cyrus, right? Hocha Doryovish. And here we're talking about Darius. So how do we get out of that? We're talking about two different kings. So the answer, and of course, again, I have to throw in our old friend Artaxasta, too. He also enters in there. So, very ingenious answer. Tada. There is a Tana who taught, or there's one of the teachers taught, it says, Who Koresh? Who Doryovish? Who Artaxasta? They're all the same, right? Cyrus is Darius, and Darius is Artaxasta, so that all three of them are the same king. Oh. Of course, I don't have to tell you that it's a little forced. It's a little forced.
It's a little forced.
Forced, right. Yeah. But nevertheless, I mean, this is his opinion because he wants to get out of the problem, you know, with the fact that we have all kinds of different dating, different names, and so on. So he says it's all the same king.
Where does that sound?
What does it sound? It sounds the fact that we can maybe agree, you know, that the month of Tishrei should be for a non-Jewish king. But of course, that's going to raise the following question. Namely, didn't we say before that Cyrus was a kosher king, right? So how does that fit in? Because if he weren't the kosher king, then in that particular case, we should say then his reign is dated always, you know, from Tishrei and not from Nisan. Okay? As this last proof says, you know, that after all, it should have said the eighth year and not the seventh year, if it's so that in Nisan, you know, you begin counting his reign, and not as the previous authority who had said that being a kosher king, so he also was counted from Nisan. All right, so that's how he gets out of it. Okay. I have to answer, too. There is one pasuk that we find also in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. By the way, at one time, Ezra and Nehemiah were considered the same book, and then they were divided into two. Of course, you know, you have two different heroes to begin with. But actually, later on in the book of Nehemiah, Ezra also appears on the scene. Okay. At any rate, there is one passage where they call back, they recall the fact that Cyrus had given permission to the Jews to rebuild the temple. Remember, the Jews were under terrific pressure in Jerusalem at this time. They had plenty of goyim who were enemies of the Jews. There was Sanballat, who was the leader of the anti-Jewish forces. Sanballat Hachorani. Hachorani would mean that he came from the Golan area, okay? And then there was another guy by the name of Tuvia, who was the Ammonite. So you can see, by the way, the fact that, you know, they had Jewish names is interesting. Of course, they were goyim, but obviously, you know...
Is this the book of Nehemiah?
Yes, right. And so Nehemiah, you know, calls back to the mind, you know, the fact that the Jews did receive permission from Cyrus, right? Artaxasta and Doryovish. To do what?
Rebuild.
To rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah. So since the three of them are mentioned in the same breath, yeah. So this possibly may be a reason why he says that these three characters are all one and the same person. Okay? And this is his reasoning. Okay. Why was he called Koresh? Because Shemelech Kosher Haya. He was a kosher king. That's why his name was Koresh. Of course, it's hard to see the relation unless you simply say that there are three letters, right? Kosher is spelled Achof and Ashin and Aresh. And Koresh is also spelled, right, with a Kaf and a Resh and a Shin. So, you know, obviously then... Right. Let us get mixed up. Okay, right. All right. So that's probably the reason, I would say, that he says that. Okay. So when he was a kosher king... Right. All right. So when he was kosher, he was Koresh. Atashashta. Why was he called Atashashta or Artaxerxes? It says, Al Shem... Al Shem Malchuso. Alright. This was the name given to his kingdom. I don't know really where there is any justification, but we had a similar business, remember, with Vayishba Haknani Melech Arad. Remember that? It was on the previous page over there. When the Canaanite king, the king of Arad, heard and so on, and then they identify him with Sichon and they ask the same question, you know. Sichon and Canaan and Arad, I mean, why are they all lumped together and so on? So the answer is, you know, that one was the place where he lived, and another one, you know, that Sichon was his name, others say that Arad was his name, and so on and so forth. We had that on the previous page, okay? All right. So, at any rate, if we say over here, right, that Koresh was, he was called that because he was a Melech Kosher, Atashashta, because this was the name of the kingdom given to him. Maybe it means, let's say, the dynasty of Atashashta, something like that, okay? Umashmo, and what actually was his real name? It was Daryavishmo. This was his name, okay.
The real king's name.
Yeah, right, okay. So, at any rate, the Kol Mokom, nevertheless, in any case, says the Gemara, Kasha. It's a difficulty. There's a contradiction between one and another. So how do you resolve the difficulty? So, yeah, that's what kasha means. Kasha means it's difficult. Literally. Right, right. When you frag a kasha in Yiddish, I mean, it's because, you know, you're asking a difficult question that needs resolution, right? And it may not be easy to resolve that particular question. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Amar Rabbi Yitzchak said, like Kasha. Nah, it's not difficult, he says. Nah, Khan, he says, Kodim Shehechmitz, Khan, Lacha Shehechmitz. He says, when was he called Koresh? In other words, when was he the kosher king? It was Kodim Shehechmitz, which means literally before he turned sour, before he turned vinegary. In other words, before he went off the right path, okay? Right. But Khan, then they called him Daryavish, Atashashtor, L'Acha Shehechnitz, after he turned sour and no longer the kosher king, Koresh, okay? That's what Rabbi Yitzchak says. Okay. Maskev lo Rab Kano. So Rab Kano says, wait one moment, he says, Umi Hechnitz. Did Koresh actually turn sour? Did he really go off the path of righteousness? The Hawks here, don't we have a pasuk? We're now on the top of page of Daf Dalet. Let me stop this for a moment. Okay, we are now continuing on the top of Daf Dalet Amud Aleph. Okay, now Rav Kalman just asked the question: did Koresh actually turned bad? Didn't he remain a tzaddik? A chosid, whatever you want to call him. In other words, a good person, right, as far as his relation to the Jews is concerned. And now they quote a pasuk that we find again in the book of Ezra, okay? This is in connection when he harks back to, you know, Cyrus's decree, and at that time, Cyrus gave Ezra permission to go to Yerushalayim, and he says the following. He says, Uma Chashchon, and whatever they need, in other words, Ezra should bring with him whatever will be necessary for the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, and also for establishing the worship in the Beis HaMikdash. Uvenei Torin, for example, Torah over here doesn't mean what it means in Hebrew. In Hebrew, the word Torah means a young dove. Normally, Uvenei Torin would mean young doves, which also was sometimes used as a sacrifice, by the way. But this is really based on the Aramaic, where Tor in Aramaic is like shore in Hebrew. Okay?
Taurus.
Right, right. Okay, so in other words, B'nai Torah would be young bulls, okay? Bulls.
Bulls.
Young bulls, right.
A male cow.
Right. The Dichrin. Dichrin are rams. Yeah. Yeah, that's related to the word Zachar, okay? Okay? Bayimrin, these are sheep. La alavon, of course, is an Aramaic, so you have to. Alavon means for aliyot, for sacrifices, for olot. Okay. Le'anoh Hashmaya, to the God of Heaven. So he's telling him, you know, to take all kinds of animals that he'll need in order to offer up sacrifices to the God of Heaven, and incidentally, on whose behalf are these sacrifices? On behalf of Koresh, on behalf of Cyrus. You understand? This is what he's telling him. It's not just, you know, on behalf of the Jewish people, but he wants to be remembered in the sacrifices that they will offer up in the Beis HaMikdash as well. Okay? Yeah. What he wants. Okay? And what else? Chintin. This is like the word chitim. Chita, right? Wheat, right? Melach. Salt. That's the same word. Chamar. This is, of course, wine. Amashach and the oil. Right?
Right?
Yeah, this is Aramaic, okay. Kima'amar kahanaya d'Yerushalayim. Even in accordance with what the Kohanim in Yerushalayim have said. Le'avu misyahev lahem, let it be given unto them. Yom b'yom. Right? Day by day. Dilo shalu, and without fail. In other words, everything that they'll require, let it be given unto them. So, Omalo Rabbi Yitzchok. So Rabbi Yitzchok said, remember who was the one who was objecting to Rav Kana, right? Rav Kana said he was a good king, so why are you insulting him, right? So Rabbi Yitzchok, on the other hand, said that he was what? He was a bad king, right? So so what did Rabbi Yitzchok say to him? So Omalo Rabbi Yitzchok. So Rabbi Yitzchok said, Rabbi, it says, Rebbe, it says, Mitunach. From your literally from your burden, in other words, like from the argument that you're going, I can prove that it's not so. He says, look, what is written over there? Says further on, you know, in the Pasuk, so he said, you know, that Koresh told him to take all kinds of animals and so on for the sacrifices and the other things that they would need, like, for example, salt. Well, chitin, why do they need wheat? Obviously, because we have what we call mincha. In other words, the sacrifice that consists of flour, okay? In other words, they bake cakes, cookies, whatever it may be, and so on, that they give matzah, you name it, okay? All right? And, of course, what do they need, for example, the salt? It's a pasuk in the Torah. It says, for every korban, you have to put on salt. Okay, so they need a store of salt as well. Okay? And then wine, of course, I mean, obviously, right? We need that for the libations. And mashach, the oil, again, that has various uses, as, for example, in making some of the solace and so, you know, the fine flour, you have to mix it with oil in order to make a fine cake or something like that, you understand? So they need all of these supplies. So now the pasuk then continues and he says, look, you know what it says? He says, Dilahon me'akorvanin nichochin le'lo nishmai. He says, look, these things will be used as sacrifices. Nichochin, in other words, as pleasing sacrifices to the Beinish Lam, to Elohim Shmaya, right, to the God of Heaven. Umitzalinun, and he says, and also you should pray Lechaye Malko Uvenohi, for the life, in other words, for the welfare of the king and his family, his children, and so on. In other words, what is Rabbi Yitzchok implying over here? He says he's not such a tzaddik, because in reality he has an ulterior motive. He's doing it because he wants the Jews to pray for him. He figures he could use a good prayer. So this is what this is the reason why he's offering that. But
he didn't have to do it,
no, he didn't have to do it. Of course not. I would agree with Rav Chisto that you know, he probably was a good king. But listen, as you can see, people differ. Some people think that Bill Clinton is a nice guy, and others, I don't have to tell you what they feel about Bill Clinton, right?
Go back too, for the purpose of,
yeah,
of,
right,
of
right.
Building
yes, back. Right. Yeah.
Are they implying that this king was a practicing Judaism?
No. But what they are implying is that he was sympathetic to Judaism, and you know, he wanted that the temple should be rebuilt, not only for the sake of the Jewish people, but for his own welfare as well. Right.
Just one thought.
Yes.
The thing about salt.
Yes.
Is that where we get our idea of kosher meat? If was a Jews to draw the blood out, which was put aside when they did the
Okay. Possibly. The only reason I say possibly is because, you know, a sacrifice, you had different things. You had different types of sacrifices. Some sacrifices, you know, were eaten by people and so on. So you could say that maybe the salting had something to do with that. Other
temple,
sacrifices
were
completely
blood.
Burnt.
Yeah.
No. Take away the blood, okay, you don't take away all the blood, you take away some blood because of the fact that you have to take a bucket of blood in order to pour on the mizbeach, right,
okay,
but, right, I would say it's more the our sages who developed a method of koshering in order to remove the salt, in order to remove the blood, okay, yeah, right, yeah, that the Torah says specifically,
right.
You're not allowed to eat chelev. Chelev is fat. It doesn't. Yeah. And or blood. But I have to explain. There's a difference between chelev and between shuman. Shuman also means fat. But shuman you can eat. For example, a piece of corned beef which has a little fat on it, binbeg. That's okay. That's shuman. That's not chelev. Okay. Chelev is it's fat that adheres to certain parts of the anatomy of the animal. Kidneys and some other parts and so on. So that has to be removed, okay? And this is part of the problem that you have, you know, that when you are what we call menaker, in other words, you have to purge the animal of all forbidden fats and things like that, you know, you have to have a person who knows how to do this job. Yeah.
The blood goes back to Noah.
Pardon me?
The blood goes back to Noah.
Yeah, well, except over there, they're more interested about the shedding of blood more than anything else. Yeah, but nevertheless, look, the Torah specifically forbids us to have either chelev or blood, so it's no question about it. Okay, all right. So now the Gemara asks the following question. All right, so the king says, right, that build the Beis HaMikdash, and I'm sending you sacrifices, and you should sacrifice for me and also pray for me to God, right, for the life of the king and his family, right? So he asked the following question right now. This is Rav Chisto that's asking the question, right? He says, Man do avad hochi, lamal yisrahi, tell me, somebody who does this, isn't this a good quality? Isn't this a good thing that he's doing? So why do you say that he's what? That he turned sour, that he turned bad? Oh, Tanya, as a matter of fact, he says, we have a teaching which will corroborate what I say. What is the teaching? It's written, it's Gemara and Pesach. Okay, which says, Omer Sela Zunitz Doko, I'm going to donate this Sela. Sela is like, let's say $100, okay? I'm going to give $100 for tzedakah, Bishvil Sheyichyu Bonai, so that my children, right, should have a long life. Uvishvil Sheyeske Bo Lachayo Elam Habo, and you know, that by means of you know, the tzedakah that I give, I should be worthy for the life of the world to come. So, what does the Gemara say there? The Gemara says, Hareze Tzadik Gomor. Such a person, he says, is 100% a tzadik. Okay, it's 100% tzaddik. So why are you criticizing Koresh? Because he wants, you know, he gives sacrifices and so on. He says, pray for me, make sacrifices for me. So, the answer is, Blei Kasha. No, it's not a difficulty. Kan be Yisrael, kan be Ovdei Kochavim. The difference is between a Jew and the difference between a Jew and the other is people who are idolaters. What is the difference? All right. So Rashi explains. The difference, he says, is as follows. Okay. That if a Jew prays to Rabbeinu Shlom, gives tzedakah and so on, and then, you know, his wish doesn't come true, if he is a tzaddik gomor, right, then in that case, I'll say, okay, this is the will of the Rabbeinu Shalom, and he'll accept his will, and that's it, okay? But a goy says, if a goy says that, the minute that his request is not granted, then you know what? It becomes an abdesimit. Says, what did I get out of it? I didn't get anything. So he begins to have bad feelings, you know, about the Jews for this. Okay? Okay. Look, I don't say that this is, you have to accept it 100% at face value, but this is how Rashi explains the statement over here.
It's very logical.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's logical.
Okay. So, in other words, how could you say that he's a tzaddik gomor, right, when he could have very easily have changed his mind later on? As a matter of fact, we think that the building went along, you know, the building of the Beis HaMikdash went along smoothly. It didn't go along so smoothly. It took time, there were setbacks and everything else. And maybe some of the setbacks were caused by what? By the fact that the king was not encouraging his governors locally in the land of Yehuda to help the Jews in order to accomplish the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah, so it's a possibility. All right. Okay. As I said, they don't have to accept it 100%, but that's interesting. Okay.
Can't the servants of the stars?
Of the Kachovim? Literally, it means, yeah, not servants, but that they worship. They worship the stars, the constellations, and so on. But that's right. It's a synonym for idolatry, okay? And the abbreviation would be Akum. Ayin, Chav, Vav, Mem. Akum. Means the same thing. Ovdei Kochav Mazholos, okay? All right. Or Avodas Kochav Mazholos, the same thing. Okay. All right. So, Kashi says, coming soon, coming soon. Right, the Iboy Seymo, he says, and I'll give you another possibility. The Iboy Seymo, Minalo and the Echmit, how do we know that he did turn sour? Dixiv, because we have another possibility. What is it? He gave instructions for what kind of materials to use in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. And he specified what? He says, Nidbochim, the Evan Golom, that you should make rows, Nidbach over here means like rows, of Evan Golom. Evan Golom, we have to say over here, means, fine stone, or something like that, like marble, fine marble, or something like that, okay? Because the word could also be translated in an entirely different way.
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes the word means excrement or manure.
which word now?
Galal.
Also
right.
Means wheel or something round.
No, that's
right?
Galgal.
Oh, Galgal.
Right. Yeah. But the Gemara also speaks about clay avonim. In other words, that they use stones also to make like stone jugs and things like that and so on. And there is a possibility too that some people even use hardened, let's say like cow manure or something like that, in order to make it into something. It's interesting, I mean, that these are some of the things. Matter of fact, there's even a reference in Yirmiyahu to something along the same lines. Yeah. All right. But anyway, pardon me? You mean from the Galilee? I don't know. The word, of course, by itself really means to roll something. Rolled stone,
okay.
I mean, whatever it may be. Yeah. I mean, this is why we have what? Glila, remember? What is Glila? We wrap it up. We roll it.
Like
roll
wheel,
it together.
Right?
So.
Like
well, the word for wheel, Galgal, comes from the same root, okay? It's what we would call a reduplicated root.
What? What you're quoting now.
It's coming from here.
No. The sieve, right?
Huh? Okay. All right. Let's find the text again. Okay.
Wasn't Gilgal originally an area?
You see the sieve? Pardon me? Right.
Gilgal
it is written.
An area outside
Gilgal? No, it's north of Yerushalayim. Okay. Right. This is the place where the Jews first crossed the Jordan. They came to Gilgal. Okay. All right. At any rate. And there, of course, there it's connected in the book of Yahushua. It's connected with the idea that after they came to Gilgal, they made a covenant with God. They circumcised themselves. And then it's written over there, Hayom galosi escherpas mitzrayim yaleichem. Today I've taken away the shame of Egypt from you, the fact that Jews became circumcised, which they hadn't done during the times that they were in the wilderness, the 40 years.
Okay.
All right. So at any rate, getting back to the Pasuk. All right, so the Siv, the Pasuk says, right, Nidbochim, the Evan Golol, which as I said, you know, this would be like rows of very fine stone, possibly marble is what it means, Tolosa, three rows of that. The Nidboch, the Or, Chadas, and there should be also a row of wood, which is new, or maybe one. In this case, probably means what?
No,
Hadas, the feminine form.
I still ask, where did this come from? Where is this information coming from?
This is still from Ezra. It's still a continuation of what he told Ezra to take with him to Eretz Yisrael. Okay? Yeah. Okay, sorry. Yeah, that's what it is. All right? And not only that, but it's also written, V'nifkasa in Beis Malko, right? So, Tisyahi. So, and also he says, and the expenses, nifkaso is like, you know, in Aramaic it means to take out. In other words, in Hebrew the equivalent would be the word hotza'ah, an expense, okay. And the expenses, in beis malkut yisrael, will be paid by the royal house. Okay, right. Okay. So he says, lomalei, why? The oved hachi. So why did he do it? If you claim, look, here's a pasuk which proves that he's willing to, you know, spend from the royal treasury for all these things. So why do you say that he was
sour.
He was a sour grape, right? So he says, Sovar, he says, because in the back of his mind was the following thought. He says, E mordu bi Yehudai, if the Jews will rebel against me, Ikviye Benura, then I'll burn it in fire. Now, of course, the stone can't burn, but what could he burn? He could burn the wood, and then that would destroy the structure. Okay? So, they raised the following objection. Right, let's talk in a few moments. It says, Atu Shlomo lo yavad hachi. Hey, wait a minute. You're yelling about King Cyrus. You're calling him all kinds of names, he says. Didn't Shlomo HaMelech also do the same thing? Right? The Hawk Siv is written, and it's in the Pasuk, you know, in Melachim Aleph, in 1 Kings, it's written over there, Shlosha Turei Godzis, right? That there were three rows of hewn stone, right? The Tur, Krisus HaRozim, and then a row of cut cedar. Okay? Cut cedar. So, how do you reconcile that? So he answers, Shlomo Ovad Milmala. Says Shlomo, he put the wood on top of the stone. The Ihu of Admilmato, but Koresh put the wood underneath the stone. Shlomo shakei bevinyona. Shlomo made sure that the wood was, you know, incorporated very well into the building. But Ihu lo shakei bevinyona. But he didn't want the wood to be incorporated in the building. Shlomo Sadye Besido. Shlomo then proceeded to plaster it with plaster, in other words, to cover up the wood so that it would have an additional covering over it. And Ihu Lo Sadye Besido. But he did not do so. Okay. So, in other words, what is he saying? He's saying, in other words, that, yeah, granted that there were three rows of stone and one row of wood. in the Beis HaMikdash. But the difference is that when Shlomo did it, right, the basic structure was of stone, and it had a wooden top. So, chas v'shalom, something should happen, it wouldn't destroy the whole building. Okay. But Koresh did full fartelt, as we would say. He did just the opposite. What did he do? He put the wood on the bottom and the stone on top, so that if the wood on the bottom caught fire, then the whole building would collapse. So this is why he was no Melech Kosher, he was no Tzaddik. Of course, it's the argument, you know, raised against him. Right.
Right.
They want to prove that it's Hechmes. Right. That is, the one who is espousing this theory that he was, you know, a bad king, it turns out. Right, right. Okay, I think we'll call it a night right now, and next week, in Yetz Hashem, we shall continue from this point. Okay, Layashem. Okay. Tonight is the 30th of the month of June of the year 1999. It's also take your pick. Either it's the 16th or the 17th of Thomas, depending upon the time of the night, right? And okay, we are continuing right now on Maseches Rosh Hashanah, Daf Dalet Omid Aleph. Okay, let me just review 2 minutes what the problem is that we are facing right now. Okay, we better put it here where it can be heard, because the time of the scene it didn't record. Okay, alright, remember the problem started first of all by virtue of the fact that the Mishnah says that Rosh Chodesh Nisan, right, is the beginning of the year as far as kings are concerned.
Right.
So then we had several lot of Gemara in which they prove more or less, you know, that judging from the, you know, from the Tanakh, from the Bible, that as far as Jewish kings are concerned, there's no question at all that this is the case. All right. So we established that. Then the question then was, of course, and what about non-Jewish kings, right? So with non-Jewish kings, we find out that, well, first of all, there's the opinion of Rav Chisda, for example, who said, you know, that as far as non-Jewish kings are concerned, for them, New Year's is the first of Tishrei. And he brought citations from the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, right?
Mm-hmm.
All of them, and also from the book of Daniel to a certain extent, but particularly the first three books that I mentioned, in order to show the fact that in all of these cases the dating definitely would presuppose the fact that for them it would be the first day of Tishrei as the you know, the day of the beginning of a new year of rain for them. Alright, so this is where we stood at the moment, and then they interposed the question that we see that in the case of King Cyrus, Koresh, right? So we saw over there that actually, apparently the dating would seem to be from the month of Nisan. And so that brought up a new problem. Problem was, do we consider Koresh as a Melech Kosher, right? Was he a good king, a kosher king, right? In which case then we should date his reign also from the month of Nisan. Or should we say that he was not a good king? Or as the words of the Gemara would be, the echmitz. In other words, he turned sour, and while he may have started off okay, but in the end he reverted to being a goy, and he wasn't so good. And then we brought certain examples in order to show that this is a difference of a point of view. Rav Kada believes that he was a Melech Kosher. Why was he a Melech Kosher? Because in the final analysis, first of all, we saw that he gave permission to the Jews to go and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. That's number one. Secondly, he also gave permission to the Jews that he was going to supply them in whatever needs they had. This is what we read at the top of the Daf Dalet, if you remember, that whatever they need, whether it's wheat or animals for the sacrifice or whatever it may be, that it should be granted. Okay, so God's fine. That certainly makes him a kosher king. So now the question is, so why was he a bad king? Why do they say that he wasn't a good king? So for that, One opinion was brought in, if you remember, that when it came to building of the base, argument number one was that the sacrifices that he sent, right, it was in the final analysis for his own self-interest that he did it, that he wanted the Jews to say prayers for him, because he figured, you know, that it wouldn't do any harm, you know, that the Jews also should add special prayers on his behalf. But then the argument was put, no, and if a Jew says that I give a seller's, you know, a certain amount of money to charity in order to be able to inherit the world to come, or so that my children should live long and something like that. So the Gemara says he's a tzaddik gomer, which means he's 100% tzaddik. So what's so bad about Cyrus doing the same thing? So those who are against Cyrus, so what did they say? Well, you know, it was all self-interest, and if his wishes were not fulfilled, then in that case he would turn sour, okay, against the Jewish people. This was one opinion. And then they brought another one. They said, okay, I can prove another one. You see, we have to realize that every rabbi who is now discussing this business over here has his own opinion and his own favorite citation from the Bible in order to prove it. Okay, so another citation, if you remember, was in reference to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Naturally, Cyrus donated what? He donated money and so on, and he gave orders that they should use 3 rows of stone, right? And 1 row of wood. So immediately the objection was, you know, so Shlomo HaMelech did the same thing? So then we came up with a different answer, if you remember. Namely, that when Shlomo HaMelech did it, so first of all, he put the wood on top and the stone on the bottom, so that if Chas v'Shalom, a fire should ever break out, then in that particular case, it would only affect the upper story and wouldn't affect the lower story. Plus which, it also says, you know, that he also placed the wood, he sunk it in, so it should be firm in the, you know, the pillars and so on that held everything. And also, he even plastered it over, it says. But what about Koresh? So, people who are detracting him, his detractors, they said, yeah, but, you know, he put 3 rows of stone on top and 1 row of wood on the bottom, so that if he turned against them, you know, he changed his mind and decided, you know, to that he didn't want the Beis HaMikdash anymore. All he had to do was to burn the wood on the bottom, and immediately the whole thing would collapse and so on. So, again, this is another argument. Okay. All right. So now, at this particular place, we are ready now, when we're in the middle of the page. Okay? Right. Okay, and I'll tell you where we are right now. You see a little bit, okay, you see where it says little Nehemiah over there on the side margin?
Yeah.
You see a little Nehemiah over there on the side margin, right? Okay. Yeah, I'm talking about the narrow side margin, not the fat side margin. Yeah, right inside over there. Okay, all right. Okay, count up 2 lines from there, okay? Well, that's the end of the previous idea. In other words, that Cyrus, built the Beis HaMikdash, he did not plaster it in order to provide extra security and so on. Okay? All right. So, the Gemara now continues with another argument. This time it's Rav Yosef, or maybe it's Rav Yitzchok, who are also trying to say that Koresh was not a very nice king, and I have to tell you that at this particular point, okay, it's kind of coarse. Little, okay? All right, so let's continue. Now, of course, here we face another problem that we had mentioned already 2 weeks ago yet, and that is that there seems to be confusion between Cyrus, Doryovish, Atashashta, right? And finally, one came with him and said, he's Cyrus, he's the Yovish, and he's Atav Shavshan. He's all three of them, okay? So that naturally, if in that case we're talking about Koresh, right? But it could apply equally to whom? To either Dor Yovish or Atav Shavshan. In this particular case, it happens to be Dor Yovish, okay? Because he was the king who was reigning in Babylon, that is in Persia, excuse me. And if it was in Shushan Abir, if you remember, okay, the capital city. He was the king who was reigning at the time when he commissioned Nehemiah to go back again to Yerushalayim, to go to Yerushalayim. And it wasn't Cyrus, it was really Daryavish. Darius, or Daryavish, okay? Daryavish. Darius, right, okay, yeah, okay. Who had commissioned Nehemiah to go back to Yerushalayim and there to supervise the rebuilding of Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash and see that the things got off on the right start again. Okay, yes?
I can't put that for me.
Yeah.
Why the concern about the calendar for the Jews against the calendar for the Israelites?
Because obviously they're trying to reconcile the fact that when it came to these kings, we saw that, for example, something that happened in Shvat, and something that happened later on, but it's still part of the same year. It said Esrim Shona, if you remember. Okay? So therefore, it would show that in that particular case, that Rosh Chodesh Nissan was not the New Year's as far as a non-Jewish king is concerned. In contrast, wherever we talked about a Jewish king, we saw that the calendar there would date it everything from the month, you know, that or from the year that the people of Israel left Egypt, and since that, of course, was on the month of Nisan, so everything would be dated from that point. Yes. Now, as far as whether they like non-Jewish kings, that's already a different problem. And obviously, over here, we're going to come now to somebody who certainly did not like a non-Jewish king.
Is this comparable to the way we have it in America? Rosh Hashanah, let's say we count from, you know, we count from the Jewish calendar.
Yeah.
Our months.
Right.
And we live in a land where the rest of the nation counts from January.
Yeah, that's correct.
So
right.
In a way.
Yeah. Right.
Similar. That would be the comparable.
Yeah. Right. And where the government counts from, let's say, July 1st or whatever it may be, as far as the fiscal year is concerned, yeah. Or we're in public schools or colleges and so on. Right, September seems to be the beginning of the school year, okay. So, all right. Now we come down to this criticism. Huh?
Not in Europe.
April or May, yeah. Okay. Yeah, all right. Because, you know, all right, very good. All right, so at any rate, the Gemara now says, Omer Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yosef said the following, V'itemer, but there are those who say that it was Rabbi Yitzchak, okay? The reason why it says V'itemer, and there are those who say, is for the simple reason, you know, they tried to remember who was the author of a particular statement, since it was all oral. Remember, this was not written down until several centuries after the argument was made,
right.
Okay?
And there was no written record.
No, some people may have had some private notes or something like that. This is what happened in the case of the Mishnah, that some people made their own private notes until finally there was an official redaction of the Mishnah. But when you consider, you take Pirkei Avos, where they trace the tradition from the time that the Torah was given to us on Mount Sinai and that passed through the hands of from Moshe to Joshua to elders, the elders to the Nevi'im, and so on and so forth, until finally reached the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. All right, so the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah were the group of sages who rebuilt Jewish life after the establishment of the second Beis HaMikdash, okay? And, you know, some of the people that we mentioned over here, such as Zechariah, Haggai, Malachi, they were members of this last of the ancient Knesset HaGdolah. Mordechai was another one, according to tradition, and so on. So these were all people. All right. Now, what would be the year for that? Roughly, let's say, about 500 before the Common Era. Give or take, about the 20, 30 years. Okay? And then they begin quoting, you know, Shimon HaTzadik, who was the last one. All right, so good. So, according to one tradition, Shimon HaTzadik lived in the time of Alexander the Great, because there's some famous stories told about the meeting of Shimon HaTzadik and Alexander the Great. Okay? All right.
I have not found it.
What, the story?
The Bible does not mention Shimon HaTzadik.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Shimon HaTzadik is quoted, right. Yeah. Let's see, where is it? With Shabbos HaErev, and I forget already. Yeah. But, sorry, I forget that it's the Shabbos HaErev. That I would have to check and see. Okay, yeah. But, you know, that's where the story is told, you know, about how, you know... Right, yeah. Okay, so, that's already, what, about the year 300, give or take again, right, prior to the Common Era, okay? When was the Mishnah finally put together in official form? The answer is in the year 200 of the Common Era. So figure out, in other words, it's a span of at least 500, 700 years or something like that. And so all the traditions, and in turn, of course, when the disciple, the pupil, you know, became a teacher in his own right, so he passed it on to the next one. And this is the way we have the chain of tradition extending over the course of centuries, okay? So finally, in the year 200 of the Common Era, they decided to make the text of the Mishnah. But once the text of the Mishnah had been established, and by the way, there were also those oral traditions that had not been voted in, so to speak, into the official text of the Mishnah, as, for example, the Tosefta, or we have various Baraisas. Baraisas means statements that are outside, but they're continually being quoted. In many cases, they're very authoritative, okay? So, we now had a text, so to speak, about which people could begin learning and discussing. God's fine? So we have another 300 years of discussions and trying to understand the Mishnah, trying to interpret it, trying to give the sources of it, and so on and so forth, the reasoning and so on. Finally, this was put together in about the year 500 of the Common Era in Babylonia by Rabbani, Rabashi, and so on and so forth. Okay, so they were the redactors of the Babylonian Talmud as more or less we see it today. Okay? I say more or less, because after all, there were, you know, the traditions that continued and so on. And all right. So, again, how did they remember all these things? Well, the answer is, you know, they brought in these citations and then they discussed it to see whether they would harmonize, whether they contradicted. If they contradicted, then in that case, what kind of a conclusion could we draw? Could we say definitely there is a halacha that follows so and so? Or should we leave it up in the air and say that halacha was not decided in the text, and then we would have to leave it for later authorities to come up with a discussion as to what the halacha might be? So that this is the process that we have. And this is why when I say we come across a word like ve'itemo, and there are those who say that it wasn't this one, but it was the other one, right? That's because they had different traditions as to who actually was the author of the statement. Now we come to the statement itself. All right? As I said, this is based upon a citation taken from the book of Nehemiah, and as we'll see, also, they're going to drag in a citation from the book of Daniel at this point. Okay. So, Omar Rav Yosef Yitem Rav Yitzchak, right? Rav Yosef said, and there are those who say it wasn't Rav Yosef, but it was Rav Yitzchak. Okay. It says, Menalon, how do we know the Echbitz, you know, that again, that Cyrus or Doryavish or whatever, as I said, since we say that they're all the same man, so I'll call him Cyrus, okay. How do we know that he turned sour, right? So he quotes now, first of all, a pasuk, a verse that we find in the book of Nehemiah. Vayomer li hamelech, and the king said unto me, Vahashegol yosheves etzlo, and the shegol, which means the queen, was sitting right next to him. Okay? Now, I have to tell you, when Nehemiah is talking, he's very considerate, very thankful, not only to the king, but also to the queen. Okay? Very considerate. Obviously, he portrays him in a very fine spirit, and so on. She's a fine woman, and so on. And the word Shegol over here is used in a very fine sense. Let me stress it again. It's used in a very fine sense. So some who translate the word Shegol as consort. Okay? But that's only an English translation. The fact is that he's referring to the queen, and as we'll see, there's a posuk in Tilum which would corroborate this idea. Okay? And if it's Tilum, Tilum is much earlier than this. Okay? All right. This is already the next one, but we have a copy over here. Okay, Bob? I think we still have a couple of more back there. Okay. Yeah, at any rate. So, you know, the king, right, made the following statement to Nehemiah. That's, you know, where he tells Nehemiah that he can go back and, you know, to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, etc., etc., and go back to Yerushalayim, because, as we said, when we quoted on the previous page, when they quoted Nehemiah, if you remember, not only was the king concerned, you know, that Nehemiah looked very sad, which was not his usual demeanor, but the queen also, she felt that it's something, so that's why I say, she is portrayed in a wonderful spirit in the book of Nehemiah. Now along comes whoever said it, whether it's Rav Yosef or Rabbi Yitzchak, and they're going to use this word in a very pejorative way.
Shegol.
Okay. First of all, they quote, you know, the Gemara says, my Shegol. What is the meaning of the word Shegol? Okay? Huh?
No, not at all.
Amar Rabbi Bar Lema. So, Rabbo, the son of Lema, I guess that's the way it should be pronounced, Lema. It's not an Aramaic word, but that's his name, okay? His father was called Lema. All right. Mishmei, the Rav, in the name of Rav, okay? And you know what he says the word Shegol means? He says it means Kalbasaw. Kalbasaw means a female dog.
The bitch.
Yeah, you could also use the word bitch. Okay. This is how he interprets the word Kalbasaw. So immediately an objection is raised. Elamiyato, if that's the case, how about another pasuk in which it is written, this time it's in the book of Daniel, where it's written, the Almoro Shemaya Hiswamamto, this time Daniel is talking to Belshazzar, who was the last king of Babylonia. And if you remember the famous scene where Belshazzar, he takes out the kelim, you know, the goblets and the whatever they had, the spoils of the Beis HaMikdash, and what did he do with it? He had himself a great big drunken
orgy,
right? Okay. And at that moment, right, there was right on the wall, mysterious words, right? B'nai M'nai, Tekele Farsin, okay? And of course, nobody knew what it was all about until Daniel came and he interpreted what B'nai M'nai, Tekele Farsin means, okay? All right? So, that was the situation. So, in that particular pasuk, it's written that Daniel says to Belshazzar, he says, V'al Moro Shmai Hiswamanta, you extolled yourself over the master of heaven, of the kings. In other words, you claim that you are even greater than whom? Than Hashem, right? Umanonia debase haisiyu kodomach, and also you had the kelim of his temple brought before you. The ant, you, Raver Vaneich, and all your big shots, in other words, princes and so on. Shegla Seich, right? Your queens, and also your concubines, because obviously he had, you know, probably more than one. He was a polygamist, right? And at the same time, he also had, you know, other women as well in his harem over there, his concubines, okay? So they're all, what we're doing, naturally they're all drinking, right, and having them, so, okay. So, yeah. And what were they doing? Chamro shosin b'chol, right? They were drinking wine with, you know, with these kelim. So the Shegol called Besohi, you're going to like this. If Shegol means a female dog, a bitch, right? Then Kalbasa Matsmishtaya Hamrahi, tell me, does a female dog drink wine?
Why not?
So listen to the answer that he gives over here. He says, oh, Lakasha, no, there's no difficulty. Why? The Malfilo, the Shesaya, you can teach a dog how to drink wine.
That's like teaching a dog new tricks.
Right.
That's the old expression.
All right. So, so far now, this argument therefore proves what? That Shegol is to mean what? A female dog, right? This shame, that's why I say. It's not very nice. Okay. Elamiato, so now they raise an objection to this. It says, Dichsiv, here is the Pasuk. So Pasuk is in the book of Tehillim. It's written over there, Benos Melochim Yekoseich, Nitzava Shegol Diminecho Bechesef Ophir. Okay. Now let me give you a background, first of all, to that particular psalm. It seems to be a psalm that was written in order to celebrate the marriage of a king to a princess whom he took as his wife. Okay? So what does he say? He says that the daughters of kings, right, are there in order to show you honor, Yikor in Aramaic, but also we have it in the book of Esther that Yikor, Gdullah, and so on, the Mordechai, and so on, so there it means honor, all right? So they're there to do honor unto you. And the Shegol, right, in other words, the queen, Nitzavoli Mincha Bechesem Ophir. She is standing at your right hand, right, with a crown of gold brought from Ophir. In other words, the gold from Ophir is very, very special gold, okay? Okay. So, again, what do we have to say about the word Shegol? That it means, really, a queen. No. It means a queen, right? So now, of course, we say the Shegol Kalbisohi. So if Shegol means a female dog, the Maikam of Asiluhu Novi Swell. So what then is the prophet literally? But it means, of course, what is King David, the author of Tehillim, saying to the people of Israel? What kind of nias is he giving them, right? What kind of new suggestion? So, Hachi Ka'amar. So, they give the following explanation. I'm not finished with this yet. Okay. This is what he said. This is what the verse means, he says. Bishar Shechaviva Torah Yisrael Kishego Liyodei Kachovim. Just as the Torah is as beloved to the people of Israel as the Shegol, in other words, the female dog, is beloved by the Goyim, right? The idol, the idolaters. So it's a chisem, for this reason you, O people of Israel, because you love the Torah so, you know, so much, therefore you merit the chesem Ophir, right? For a crown of glory coming from Ophir, okay, which of course would mean the crown of glory is this is the crowning achievement, you know, the crown of Torah that you deserve, okay? So again, what do we see over here? We see that the interpretation of Shegol is not in the sense in which David HaMelech uses it, but rather to use again to detract from the character of a non-Jewish king, and in general to throw a shtickle slur and some mud, you know, at the idolaters, okay? I have to tell you, we're not finished yet with Shegol, but when I came across this Gemara, I was shocked. I find it shocking, the Mamet's Gazelle, for many reasons. First of all, after all, there are many things that we'll find in the Gemara also, where they speak, you know, in praise of good people, Jews and non-Jews and so on, right? And secondly, we still have to bear in mind, you know, that after all, if it weren't for the edict of Cyrus permitting the Jews to go back, who knows how much longer it would have taken for the Jews to come. Granted, they had all kinds of difficulties, as I mentioned in previous weeks. You know, that's why Ezra and Nehemiah had to go, and this is why Zechariah and Haggai and Malachi, they all had to come, you know, and to preach to the people of Israel, you know, to encourage them to go on with the building and, you know, to repair the walls of Yerushalayim and, you know, to establish and, you know, not to chicken out because of the fact that they had enemies all around them who were causing all kinds of problems and so on. So he has his place in history. There's no question about that, okay? And I'm sure that they were just as much aware of him as, for example, if you would read the Sefer Yeshayahu, the book of Isaiah, you'll see how he refers to Koresh as Mashiach Hashem. You know, that God anointed Cyrus specifically for this particular purpose in order to go and to tell the people of Israel to that the exile is coming to an end and that they will be able, you know, to go back and to rebuild, you see. So that's why I'm a little shocked by it. But I'm also shocked by another. I'm shocked by the fact that they use the word Shegol over here in order to do it. Now, there are pros and cons with this word. Okay, obviously over here, if King David is describing a marriage of a king to a queen, right, and he uses the word Shegol, certainly he uses it in the finest sense. Yeah, he uses it in the finest sense, there's no question about it. Not only that, but I have to tell you right now, when we stand under the chuppah, where does the chosen stand and where does the kallah stand?
Chosen stands on the right and the kallah stands on the left.
The chosen is on the right and the kallah on the left? Punkt verkehrt. Punkt verkehrt. The kallah is on the right.
And
of course, I'm talking about facing the Masada Kedusha.
Oh,
okay.
Facing the
Masada Kedusha. Okay. The audience is Shenanandamais. You see only the backs.
So
I'm talking about facing. Okay. Facing. Okay. All right. And facing, right? So in that case, the Chassan stands on the left, facing the Masada Kedusha, and the Kal on the right. Now, what is it based on? The answer is it's based on this particular Pasuk. In other words, who did they identify the bride with? With the Shegol? Of course. She?
The female.
All right. So that's why, again, as I say, I mean, I'm shocked. Okay. But nevertheless, this is what the text is, and we have to understand the text. Okay.
So, right. As opposed to the Nesuit also.
Yeah.
The Hessens favor the female dog, and the Israelites favor the male.
I have to tell you another thing now. All right, from the derogatory point of view, there is also an undertone. The undertone is that, if you remember, one of the things that the Torah speaks about in several passages is what we would call bestiality. In other words, you know, having relations with animals, okay? All right. This is obviously what they have in mind. In other words, that they're so morally corrupt that they prefer a dog, shall we say, in order to rather than to have normal relations.
Is that the
origin
of that kind of? Say, I'm interested from a linguistic point
the
of view.
Linguistic
I
point of view. This is an undertone.
Interested.
This is an undertone, but it's not present in the text that we quoted. Yeah. Not at all. Okay, this is simply something that is more apparent, for example, in the Gemara, but in Zohar, where they speak about idolatry, idolatrous practices, and, you know, there's a greater description about, you know, how the idolaters, you know, they use animals in this way, okay?
All right.
Yes.
So when they call, they're using the expression female dog.
Yeah.
I see it as not that they are assuming or making assumptions that she has had relations with an animal, but she is
the king has the
when they get down to talking about the
there's
queen,
no queen
in the same way.
There's no queen.
No, they don't mention the queen.
They don't mention the queen.
They don't mention the queen.
No.
The queen is the Shegal. Okay. But the question is, how do you interpret the word Shegal?
That's what I'm talking about. So when they use that interpretation, it's as if she were bad enough, as if she were to lie down with animals. Isn't that what we're talking about?
No. We're talking about him. We're not talking about her, actually.
Even when they call her that?
Yeah, right. Yes.
Go ahead. Okay. Thank you. I just have
yields.
Let's say Bikrasai.
Bikrasai, among those who give honor unto you. Yeah. Okay. Bikrasai. Right. Okay. All right.
The fact that there's special laws in the Torah against this here,
right,
would indicate that common practice among theirs, at least those who occupied the Canaan.
Yeah, no question. Of course, we're told not to go, according to the Chukas HaGoy. I mean, the their own practices is one of the things that's prohibited. All right. Getting back over here then. All right. So, as we see, here is a pasuk taken from Tehillim, which speaks very highly about the queen, but nevertheless, he's going to interpret it, in a derogatory way in order to prove his point. What? That Shegol is a derogatory word. Okay.
Who is doing the interpretation? The Gemara?
Okay, in this case, it happens to be a guy by the name of Rabbi Bar Lima.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. And if you wish, Le'erlam Shegol Malkasohi, right? If you wish, you could say, yeah, the word Shegol really means queen, right? But Rabba Bar Lima Gemara Gamila. But Rabba Bar Lima, he had a tradition to the fact that that the meaning of the word Shegol is Kalbasa. Okay, all right. Then when he had a tradition, he had a tradition. In other words, he heard it from somebody and he repeated it. Okay, and then in that case, Abamai calling her Shegol. So why did he call her Shegol? Right. Yeah. Let's see where we go. My eyes went off someplace. Okay. Yeah, Kori Lo Shegel, right. Sheho Yisro Chaviva Lovki Shegel. The answer is because the dog, this is obviously, was as beloved to him as the queen itself. Okay.
As a queen.
Yeah. Inami, or another interpretation, Sheho Shivo Bimakam Shegel. That he put his dog. He had his dog sit down in the place where the queen normally would be seated.
But
okay.
From there, you really can't necessarily interpret a sexual overtone, just that statement.
Well, I would say that we have the implication being that. Okay. Okay. All right. I have to tell you also that there is one use of this root. In the Bible, in fact, in two places. One is in the Torah, in the Chumash, right, in the Torah, and the other one happens to be in the book of Zechariah, okay, where the implication is that the root is used for sexual intercourse, okay. Shin Gimel Lamed is used in the sense of sexual intercourse, okay, but it's considered such a bad word that they always use the synonym Shin Chaf Bet instead. We have what we call a Kri and a Ksiv. Now, usually Kri and Ksiv means that the way it's written is one thing, but we read it, but usually maybe, let's say there's a Vav, do I read it as a singular or as a plural or something like that, okay? For example, it's written Krue Hoedo, but we read it as Krie Hoedo, something like that, okay?
Yeah.
So that's a Kring Siv, as a normal rule, okay? But in this particular case, in the Tochicho, that we find in this particular case, that happens to be in the Vorm, Sefer Devarim, okay? Or in the last chapter of the book Zechariah, so there we substitute the word the Yishacher Yishkevena, right? Yishose a race, you will betrothed a woman, you know, and you want to make her your wife, yet, but Ishake Yishkevena. In other words, another man will actually lie with her and so on. So, but the text actually uses the word Yishkelena, but we don't read it that way. You have to read it as Yishkevena, okay? And Zechariah is a somewhat similar thing. Okay, so obviously there is something in the root itself that implies it. So the same root can either be interpreted either nicely, right, referring to the queen, and as I pointed out to you, the bride, the chuppah, and so on, the way we take it today, right? And on the other hand, you know, that's not so nice. Okay. All right. Now, finally, they're getting tired of all this business. How do we know that, you know, the Echmit? So he says, Eboy Seymour, if you wish, you can say as follows. He says, Minal on the Echmit. How do I know that, you know, he turned sour? Mehacha. It says, I'll give you another pasuk. Okay, what is the other pasuk? So now they quote from the book of Ezra. Okay? What does it say in the book of Ezra? So it says that he gave the following permission, and he said, At kesef kikorin meyo, it says, 100 silver talents. The talent is like $10,000 or something like that, okay? In other words, 10,000 talents of silver, right? The yad, let's see, where's the rest of it? At kesef kikorin meyo, right. The yad chantin korin meyo, and also another 100 kor. Kor is a dry measure, right, of wheat. The yad chamar batin meyo, and 100 bats, B-A-T-H in English, right? It doesn't mean bath, but it's a measure, a liquid measure, of wine, all right? The yad batin meshach meyo, and also 100 baths of oil. This is all he's authorized, you know, to spend from the king's treasury in order to, you know, for the service on the Beis HaMikdash. Umelach, and when it comes to salt, diloksav. There's no mention written over there, you know, as to what limit there is. So in salt, he could splurge. Okay, right, he could splurge. All right. So what's so bad? After all, he's giving authorization, you know, to spend all this for use in the Beis HaMikdash. So they say, you know what was bad about it? Says, Mi Yikora, to begin with, it was below Kitzusa. He never mentioned at the beginning any limit as to how much. Take a look on the top again. Top of the page. Okay? Tells him, you know, Machashchon, whatever they need, right? Bnei Torin, if you remember the young bulls, right? With Dichrin, the Amrin, right? And also rams and sheep and so on. Balbon, you know, for sacrifices, doesn't even mention it to the God of Heaven. And then it mentions Chintin, Melech, Hamar, right? The Meshach, in other words, wheat and salt and wine and oil. Kimamar Kanaya B'Yerushalayim, right? Whatever the Kohanim and Yerushalayim say, Levei Misyahiv Lehem, let it begin unto them. So, as you notice, there was no measure, there was no limit over there. And now, all of a sudden, he gives another decree, and he says, okay, you can spend up to 100 talents of this, 100 talents of that, 100 baths of this, 100 baths of that, 100 kor of this, and so on, and that's it. Okay. So, if that's the case, it would seem that at the beginning he was generous, right? But now he's getting stingy, right? So, Meikora, we said to begin with, below Kitzusa, right? He did not set any limit upon what he was prepared, you know, to authorize them to spend, right? The Hashta, but now in this particular pasuk, but Kitzusa, there is a limit mentioned, right? So the Gemara comes to his defense at this particular point. He says, "Vidilmomi, you currently have a kimle b'kitzusa." Maybe at the beginning he really had no idea of what limit to put, because he didn't know how much would be absolutely necessary. So, in other words, don't use this pasuk in order to prove that, you know, he was that echmitz, you know, that he turned sour. We have plenty of other things that we mentioned already before. Okay, Ela Mechuvra saw a condition in Miyakara. But obviously then, as we already had learned previously, in other words, we had plenty of other psukim before to show that, you know, he turned sour. Okay. I don't know. So what is it? They're raising the rates again today? The
slightly.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, if you remember, the Mishnah spoke not only about being Rosh Hashanah for kings, but the next word is V'lirigolim, and for festivals. Okay? Now, not sure by festivals, we mean specifically what? What are the regolim? The regolim are Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, because those are the night. Those are the times when they had to make a pilgrimage to Yerushalayim. Okay?
What conclusion have you come about Cyrus now? Is he
about Cyrus, was he good or bad?
No. He was good and then became bad, or he was always bad?
Well, the answer is they would seem to indicate the fact that to begin with he wasn't bad, because notice that they use the word chmitz, right? Wine doesn't immediately turn sour. At first, wine is good. Then it turns vinegary, it turns sour, okay? So we have to say then, if that's the case, then to begin with he was okay. He was an okay king, but after that, you know, he turned into a shtickle on to submit.
They do come to the conclusion that he was bad. He was sour all the time.
Well, yeah. Huh? Oh, no. No. Koresh, after all, first of all, Koresh is... Obviously, it's based upon his Persian name. Okay? It's based upon his Persian name. Cyrus is very far from the pronunciation. Koresh is very close to the pronunciation, but, you know, not quite the way the Persians would call him. Okay.
What's the word Mekor?
Mekor means to begin with.
So so they do say that he was sour from the beginning, to begin with.
No, what they said is Mekor, he was a Melech Kosher. He was a good king, but afterwards, you know, then Echmitz, he turned sour. That's the one opinion. But I agree with you that, you know, the real detractors of Cyrus, they're already saying, even in the back of his mind, he already had this, right? But, that's already stretching a little bit. Okay. Let's say here, we don't have to determine whether Cyrus was good or bad based upon how this rabbi looked upon it or another rabbi looked upon it. It's best really to judge, you know, from the point of view of what actually was accomplished. And what was accomplished was good and bad. I mean, obviously, the hopes of the Jews were aroused tremendously, but then there was an awful letdown when it came to the realities of going back to Israel and trying to rebuild it. Look, in our own day, we had a modern Cyrus. That was the Balfour Declaration. In 1917, the Balfour Declaration was published officially by Great Britain that, you know, His Majesty's government looks with great favor upon the founding of a Jewish state, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. God's fine, okay? Jews throughout the world were
ecstatic,
exactly. Except for those who hated, Zion. Unfortunately, we've always had Jews who also hated Zion, okay? But, you know, the average Jew, when he heard that, he thought that you could practically hear Mashiach's times coming already, okay? But what happened to the reality? What happened when the Jews started in, you know, to come back to Eretz Israel after the First World War? Of course, by the way, there were Jews living in Eretz Israel much prior to that, too, you know. But now I'm talking about what happened now that officially the world recognized in the Balfour Declaration that Jews were entitled to build a homeland. Number one, how many Jews actually did come back as a result of that in order to build Eretz Israel? Number two.
How many did?
Huh?
You mean
from various countries. Yeah. Let's say 50,000 came back or something like that.
Maybe. At this time.
No, I'm talking about, let's say, 1919, 1920, 1921, the early 1920s and things like that. That's what I'm talking about, okay? Secondly, and then the great British government, which was so magnanimous in establishing a Balfour Declaration, what did they do then? First of all, they lopped off what was east of the Jordan River, which should have been part of Palestine, right? And they lopped it off, and they said, look, we have an Arab guy that we have to make a king someplace, so they established the kingdom of Transjordan, right? And then, of course, the name was changed to Jordan in a later period. Okay, so they immediately lopped off the greater part of the land that was supposed to be the Jewish land to begin with. And incidentally, of course, we have in Jewish history that Jews did live east of the Jordan, absolutely. It's mentioned, you know, the tribes of B'nai Gad, Reuven, and so on, you know, right, right. Yeah, 2.5 tribes, Menashe, right, that they lived over there, okay? So, and of course they continued for centuries and centuries and centuries and centuries to live over there. There were Jewish settlements. Even before the establishment of the state of Jordan, there were Jews who were living in areas over there east of the Jordan. There were Jews living over there. But the British government, you know, went back on it. And then what happened? Britain had the mandate from the League of Nations, was supposed to help the Jews develop Eretz Israel as a Jewish. Did England actually ever help the Jews do anything along those lines? On the contrary, they did everything in order to prevent Jews from coming to Eretz Israel and to discourage anything and so on and so on. So, if we were to draw a parallel between the Balfour Declaration and Britain's role and with what happened with Persia, so we have to come to a conclusion that certain things, you know, show a tremendous parallel, that Jews did not immediately flood Eretz Israel by coming back. They didn't, right? And secondly, that you know, that with the Persians too, that they blew hot and cold, as we can see, you know, from the book of Nehemiah. All you have to do is to read Nehemiah and Ezra, and you'll see that they blew hot and cold over there. So this is what it is. All right. So now we come to a new problem. Problem about the fact that the month of Nisan is the month which is the new year, so to speak, right, for
Jewish
festivals. No, we're finished with kings. Okay, we're not going to go back to kings at the moment. Okay, now we're finished. Now we're talking about Yom Tefen, Regalim. So the first question that is raised is as follows. Mishnah says, Be'echot b'Nisan, that the first day of Nisan, right, is Rosh Hashanah for what? For Melochim and Megalim, right? In other words, for kings, that all right. We discussed that, and also for Regalim, right? For festivals. So the Gemara says, "Be'echad b'Nisan hu." Do you mean to tell me that the first festival that we have is the first day of the month of Nisan? On the contrary, "B'chamisha also b'Nisan hu." When is the first day of Pesach? The 15th day of the month of Nisan. So how can the Mishnah use the term then, Rosh Hashanah, and apply it to what? To Regalim. It's not exact. So Omar Rav Chista said as follows, says, okay, understand it as how? As Regal Shebo Rosh Hashanah Regalim, that the festival which occurs in the month of Nisan is actually the Rosh Hashanah for the festivals of the Jewish year. Okay? Because, you know, we are so oriented that Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the new year, right? That we always think in terms of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, right? Sukkot, and only after that do we have Pesach and Shavuos, okay? That's the way our year today runs, okay? But, from the point of view of the Bible, the year Taka began with Pesach being the first festival because it occurred in the first month of the year, right? And then Shavuos, of course, occurs on the third month, right? And Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, they all occur in the seventh month of the year. Okay? That's from the point of view of the Bible. All right. So, if that's the case, then what Rav Chisda is saying is that the month of Nisan is the month in which the Rosh Hashanah of festivals actually takes place. All right. So now the Gemara is asked the following question. Nafkim hino. So tell me, what is the practical law that we can derive from it? Okay, I don't know if you ever heard the expression "by enough community." You know, what's the what practical?
What's the bottom line?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, exactly. Okay, right. What is the practical? Right. Yeah. What? Okay. So, enough community says this plays a role in the following situations. Okay. Lenoder, Lemekam Alei Beval Ta'acher. All right. Which means, Noder is a verb. Noder means that you make a neder. A neder is a vow that you make. Okay, we'll discuss soon again what kind of vows. But in general, now we're making a general statement that if you make a vow, right, Torah says, right, Lo Sa'acher L'Shalma. You should not delay in fulfilling it. Okay? That's what the Torah says. So therefore, if we delay in fulfilling what we have promised, we are guilty of violating a precept in the Torah not to be ma'acher, bal ta'acher, right? Do not delay, don't be late, don't delay with fulfilling it. Okay. Very important thing. Naturally, it means, you know, that in general, if you make a promise to someone, try to keep it, okay? If you don't try to keep it, then in reality, it is a violation. I'm not saying that you're going to have to pay a fine or anything for that, okay? But nevertheless, it is a violation of the law, right? Yeah, correct. That's why if you make it, say, believe that, okay? Right. Yeah, of course, this is why we have this whole business, you know, that you have to be Matir Nedarim. I mean, in another week, we'll be reading Parsha Matos. What is the very first thing that we have at the beginning of Parsha Matos? It deals with Hatoras Nedarim. Oh, that it should be done in this son. Well, all right, let's continue. Hold it in the abeyance, okay? Hold it in the abeyance for a moment. Right. All right, so we said it makes a difference when it comes to the violation, right, of the fact that you should not delay in fulfilling what you have promised. Okay? All right. For Rabbi Shimon, he, the Tanya. And it's Rabbi Shimon who learned the following. It says, Echad ha-noder, v'yechad ha-magdish, v'yechad ha-marich. Okay. Makes no difference whether a person is a noder, or a magdish, or a marich. Now, explanation. What are they? Okay. Noder, you make a vow, you make an oath, specifically that you're going to give a neder. In other words, normally the word noder in this particular case means that you promise that you're going to give a sacrifice to the temple. Okay? That's what the word means. Rashi gives here a somewhat different interpretation, I have to tell you, that he interprets it in a different way, but I'll come to what Rashi has to say, because afterwards we'll have a greater explanation of these things. Okay? All right. There's no reason, I mean, Rashi has his opinion, but you know, you could also take it in the noble sense that the word noder means. Because the Torah says about neder and nedova, you know, if you give a neder or nedova, of course, you know what it means, okay? But again, we're also talking about animals, sacrifices that you offer up, you know, to the base of English, okay? You feel good-hearted, so you want to make a sacrifice, okay? So you say, this animal, right, will be a sacrifice. Or I promise to give a sacrifice on the base of English. Makes a difference whether you say one or the other. Difference is that what happens, I mean, if I say, for example, I'm going to offer an animal, let's say I'm going to offer a sheep. All right, let's say I'm going to offer a sheep as a sacrifice. Then in that particular case, if the particular sheep that you had designated should happen to die before, then in that case you're free of your obligation. Excuse me, you're not free. No, punkt verkehrt. You're not free. You have to bring, if this animal dies, you have to bring another one. Right. But if you say, this animal I'm giving, you know, as a sacrifice, in that case, if this animal dies, then in that case you're putter. Okay. So that's the difference between the dener and the nedov. Okay. But otherwise, the two of them mean exactly the same.
Equal
right.
Money?
Huh?
Wouldn't you still have to give the equal of money?
No, not if you say this animal. But if you say, right.
If you say the other way, which is?
I'm offering a sacrifice, okay? I'm offering an owner, let's say, or I'm offering a sheep or whatever, right? The nugget. If this animal dies, then you have to give another one instead. Okay. All right. So that's the basic difference over there. All right. So neider, in any ways, as we see, it means that you offer an animal. All right. So now, what is the next word over there? Makdish. Okay. So what is makdish? The answer is that makdish normally is that you dedicate something to the Berech HaBayis. In other words, the first one you gave your offering as a sacrifice, okay? So it's meant specifically for sacrificial purposes. But makdish, you can declare that I hereby dedicate this as a gift to the Beis HaMikdash. It could be an animal, it could be a field, it could be a house. These are all possibilities, okay?
Sure.
Right. So if you say that, then in that particular case, let's say the animal. The animal in that case is not meant for a sacrifice. Instead, either the Beis HaMikdash could use it for a purpose, or more likely, they will sell it, or even the person who dedicates it will sell it, get the money, and then give the money as a gift to the Beis HaMikdash, okay? If it is a house or a field, then in that case, he could buy it back from the Beis HaMikdash, and he gives, in addition to the original price, he also gives an extra amount of money, okay? So, alright, so he is makdish in this case. In other words, he says, I hereby dedicate my field, let's say, to the Beis HaMikdash, okay? So that goes to what we call Berech HaBayis, which means the general temple fund, okay? But not used for sacrifices, okay? That's a different fund, okay? All right, and the third one is Amarich. Okay, the last chapter in Sefer Vayikra, Book of Leviticus, the last chapter particularly deals, it does deal, first of all, also with Hekdesh. All right, Desh is another, what we call the general act of being Makdesh on you. Because in later times, the word Hekdesh became identified with a rundown place. It looks like a Hekdesh. But that's not the original meaning of the word, right?
Well, I think it's like, no.
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Because they began to use the word Hekdesh as a place where poor people, they had no place elsewhere to stay, so they would come in a special house that was built. But needless to say, they didn't particularly have a good caretaker in charge of the house or anything. So that's the reason why eventually the word Hekdesh became synonymous with that. Okay? So, so much for the word. All right, but here we're going to the original meaning of the word Makdish, okay. And what about Ma'arich? What's Ma'arich? So that's the major part of that particular chapter. Person says, Erkiolai. Torah gives different evaluations. This could be 30 shkolim, another one could be 50 shkolim, another one could be 20 shkolim, another one 10 shkolim, all dependent, 5 shkolim even, upon the age of the person who is Ma'arich, right? Or also upon the subject.